This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Gobblefunk and Glyphs, Creating Words in Children's Fantasy. And we're delighted this week to introduce back our special guest, in fact, our first ever guest, James Nicol, who is the author of The Apprentice Witch, which has been a bit of a runaway hit. And he's taken time out from his busy schedule to come back and talk to us about that.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. So, it's tell us. To be back.
We're very, very glad to have you back. We're glad to have snatched you. Now, the last time we spoke, it was in the run-up before The Apprentice Witch came out.
Seems like years ago.
and now it's been out for a few weeks. So before we start on the episode, just tell us what's it been like these last few weeks for you.
It's just been absolutely amazingly, wonderfully, knackeringly brilliant. I don't think it's still quite sunken in, everything that's happened. So I'm planning some kind of writerly nervous breakdown around mid-September when I think it probably will all hit me with great force. And I'll probably just be a gibbering wreck for a few days or something. But it's just been huge fun. But it's very tiring as well, the amount of concentration you have to put into kind of, you know, remembering where you're supposed to be from one day to the next is quite something.
Yeah. I imagine the energy you have to put into it as well, because I mean, just turning up regularly at the library and doing children's sessions in general as a librarian is
I've done like children's events and things in the past, but generally, you know, you sort of do, you know, perhaps a couple a week or one a week, but sort of like doing three or four a day for, you know, two, three solid weeks is quite, yeah. I think looking back on it, I'm thinking, goodness me, how did I manage it? But when you're there doing it, it's so much fun. The children are all fantastic that you just kind of go with it. And each visit and each event is kind of takes on its own thing as well from the group of children you're with, so it's different every time, so that kind of keeps it fresh for you as the person kind of performing, so that kind of helps as well. But yeah, it's just been just awesome. I love it.
And you've had some great success already, I mean, with sales and ranking.
Yes, I know, it keeps popping up in different charts all over the place. People kindly sending me photos and tweeting pictures of it in different charts and things, and yeah, sales seem to be going well and nice reviews as well, though I was one of these people that was like, I'm not going to read reviews because, you know, and I have, so there we go.
I think the thing is, you always say that and then you can't help yourself, at least with the first few.
No, I think it's good.
Yeah, no, and it's lovely. It's so nice to see people reading it and enjoying it as well. And I think some of the nicest things, although it's lovely when, you know, family and friends and grown-up other writers and people like that tell you they've read it and enjoyed it, but there's nothing nicer than when a child comes up to you and says that they've read it and present you with a well-thumbed copy of your book and ask you to sign it. So I've had that a couple of times now, because obviously when you're doing the events in schools and things, there's very few children that will have read the book at that point.
A lot of
the events were in the lead up to publication day and then just immediately after. But then I've done some other bits since then as well, and there's been a few that have come up and said, I've read it and I really enjoyed it. And that's really special, I think, for that to happen.
I got my
first piece of fan mail as well from a young lady called Miranda, who took it into her local bookshop and asked them if they could get it to me. And through the wonders of publishing being a small world, it just so happened that the person that ran the bookshop is another future Chicken House author. And so she passed it on to me. And I had this lovely review from Miranda. She gave me 9 3/4 golden balls out of 10. She said she really, really enjoyed it, but she didn't like any of the boys in the book. She thought the boys were all stupid. So I think if I take all the boys out of book 2, then I'll probably get 10 golden balls out of 10. That's obviously the thing that was letting me down.
Poor Colin. Poor Colin.
I know, we'd miss Colin if he wasn't there, I think.
I thought Colin was quite sweet, actually.
I guess also because of the name, I imagined him as Colin Morgan from the guy who played Merlin. That's probably not who I was he was supposed to look like at all, but
whoever you want him to look like, I think that's who he looks. But he was saved thanks to a friend of mine who read a very early draft or a little bit of a very early draft and said, "Oh, I really like Colin. Is he in it later on?" And I was thinking, he wasn't going to be, but perhaps I should bring him back for a little bit of extra, Colin at the end. So yeah, it was thanks to my friend Katie that Colin played a bigger role than he would have done originally.
Well, it was nice. And going back to sort of all your school visits, I'm sure that well, maybe this has already happened, but you're in the unique position where maybe you have inspired someone in one of those schools to be a writer themselves.
Oh, I mean, that would be amazing, wouldn't it? I hope, I can only dream that that sort of thing might happen. I mean, when I was growing up, we didn't really get visits from authors into school. I vaguely remember in sixth form, I think there was a connection with the local literary festival, and we got some quite high flying literary types come in, but I don't, because I wasn't doing English at that point, I wasn't invited to see those lovely authors. And certainly at primary school, we didn't get author visits then. I think it's a fairly recent thing in a way. We used to get the Norwich Puppet Theatre come. That was quite fun. But yeah, I think, yeah, it's quite interesting. And the questions that children come up with as well are just brilliant. They certainly keep you on your toes.
That was going to be my next question, was going to be, what is the best question you have been asked by a child so far?
Okay, so I think the best one was, do you think your book is better than J.K. Rowling's? And I said, yes, I do. Actually, the really fantastic question I was asked, I was at a school, St. George's School in Boston in Lincolnshire, and they interestingly brought in some very young children into the talk because it's a very small school, so I think they wanted it to make it look like they had more children there than they really did. And so they brought some, I think they were year one children in, which is much, much younger than obviously the readership of the book, but they'd obviously done some preparatory work with all of the children before my visit. And I sort of said at the end, "Has anybody got any questions?" And this tiny little lad at the front put his hand up, and I said, "Yes, what would you like to ask me?" And he sort of fiddled around in his pocket for a couple of seconds and pulled this piece of paper out, and he said, "I wrote it down so I wouldn't forget what my question was." And I was like, "Oh, how wonderful." And he said, "Which was the first bit of your book that you wrote?" So he obviously just didn't assume that I'd written it from the beginning to the end. So I thought that was a really interesting question. Whether he'd been, I'm now suspecting that was a plant, actually. I think it was a plant.
I don't know, because
That he'd been fed that line.
they sometimes think about things in a, they don't necessarily automatically default to a linear progression of thought.
No,
Children, I find it's only
that
later
was
that gets imposed on them. I know this
interesting.
from talking to children in the library about what sort of books they like, and once they decide I'm not going to bite them or anything, I get some really quite interesting feedback about the sort of books they like and the books they want in. So I don't know, might not be a plant.
Hopefully not.
So, congratulations to you, James. It sounds like you've been
Thank
having
you.
a great time, and yeah, I'm a big fan of The Apprentice Witch. I gobbled it up from start to finish.
Yep,
Totally
me
in love
too.
with it. Yeah. So,
Thank you.
really looking forward to book two. Now, the inspiration behind this episode, when we decided that we had to have you back, was one of the things I absolutely loved about the book was the words that you came up with. One in particular is glyphs, but there were also names such as the moon hare, and I loved it because they were so, you knew exactly what these words were without having ever heard them before. And I just think that that's an incredibly unique skill to be able to have, to use, especially in children's fiction. And so I'm gonna turn it to you, and I'm gonna ask you, how did you come up with these words? What was the inspiration?
Well, I think with glyph, there was obviously a need in the book to explain how the magic is used in the book, and I love the idea of not having wands, because that's such a very identified thing now with Harry Potter. And I was quite keen on the use of cauldrons as well, but it just became a bit impractical for her to be constantly lugging a cauldron around. And I just thought it would take far too long. You know, if you're in an emergency situation, to suddenly whip up something in a cauldron to use, you're going to get gobbled up fairly quickly if you're that sort of a witch. I thought that kind of I would stick with this idea of the magic symbol. And obviously that's, if you look at the history of witchcraft and stuff, magical symbols are an actual thing. So I couldn't really go down that route. And in fact, when I had a meeting with Barry Cunningham at one point, he was looking at some of the glyphs. So if you've seen the book, there's the glyphs are actually illustrated in bits of the book as well. And they're my design, I'm pleased to say. And so I have a little book that has the glyphs in it, and I was showing Barry this book because it's fairly important. And he flicked quickly through it, and when he finished, he put it to one side and he sighed. And I said, "What's the matter?" He said, "Oh, I was just checking there weren't any pentagrams inside there." I think he was so worried that I was going to, you know, kind of be leading some sort of dark satanic worship with my glyphs, which wasn't, you know, but I was trying to steer well away from all of that, really, and kind of develop these symbols. And so I was trying to think up different names for what those symbols could be called. And I think I was just, you know, quite randomly doing some kind of a bit of a search for symbols and different types of symbols and what different types of symbols were called. And I think glyphs did come up as a thing, and I thought, oh, it's not something I've heard of a lot. I think I've occasionally heard it used when people are talking about, you know, ancient monuments where they've got glyphs carved onto them or something like that. So I thought hopefully it would be, like you said, hieroglyphs, it would resonate enough for people to think, oh, it's a symbol, without having to explain it too much in the book. So it just kind of, it was one of those sort of fortuitous kind of internet searchy things, but it wasn't anything that took an awful long time to kind of come up with the name for them. And then it just, like a lot of things, when you first use it, the first few times when you write it, you think, oh, that's so clunky, it sticks out like a sore thumb. And then after a while, it just becomes part of your language for the book, and it just seemed to work really well. So I'm just looking at my notice board above my desk where I've got them all drawn and all to hand for when I need a glyph or two, they're ready and waiting. So that was a fairly easy thing. But then I guess things like animal names, creature names and things like that were a little more tricky in some cases, because a lot of the magical creatures are either adaptations of mythological things or just stuff that I kind of made up but might resemble other things. Mm-hmm. And some things I used, some names that people might be familiar with, and then others which, you know, which they won't be because they were just completely made up things. So like snotlings was just thing, quite random, really. Again, I just thought I liked the idea of these sort of pesky little creatures that were called snotlings. But actually, you know, when you're actually physically handling a snotling, it's not as slimy as you would think it's going to be with a name like snotlings. But they make a lot of mess if you accidentally blow them up.
I did laugh at that bit. I sat there and laughed out loud over the bit. The other bit I laughed out loud over was the cow repelling charm. Yeah. I don't know why that really tickled me.
I know. I just love the idea of, you know, when you kind of turn... I think it's happened to me a few times when you've gone to work somewhere and you sort of find that people are doing some really unusual things and you think, what possessed you to think that was a good idea?
Yeah.
And I just love the idea that they were desperately trying to be helpful by giving everybody these charms, and but actually, you know, not really knowing what they were for, and that the mayor's wearing something that is only used for repelling cows, which is not really going to help you if you're being attacked by some dark magic creature.
No,
but a heifer, then absolutely.
Actually, that bit, it as well as making me laugh, it resonated with me on another level, and it resonated with me. And hey, I haven't talked about this for a while, Jill, so you can't get annoyed with me.
Wait for but it resonated. Word.
Fairies.
That's the one.
Oh. It resonated with me about fairies, and again about the studies that I'm doing about how different people interpret fairies in different areas. And I liked it because there was this, it demonstrated this lack of understanding with the people in the town. They didn't really understand what they were dealing with, and that's illustrated several times. They don't know the difference, they don't have the knowledge. They see other thing, and then they think there's quick answers to it. And they don't understand with it, and they don't engage with it, despite being on the edge of this magical, fantastic wood. And I loved it, because at the same time as being hilarious at times, there was almost a commentary in there, which resonated a lot with the kind of thing that I'm studying. So I really appreciated that. And I don't know whether you did it on purpose or not, but...
Well, no, I didn't. I can't even claim to have thought that that was part of it. But no, I think it was just, that was sheer comedy value, I think, there. The old cow charm.
Me reading too much into it.
But I think that's the wonderful thing, isn't it? I was reading or listening to, I can't remember, an interview with Catherine Rundell, who wrote Rooftoppers and The Wolf Wilder. And she said the most glorious thing for her is when a child comes up to her at an event and says, the favourite bit of their book was when, you know, this happened and that happened. And she said, and it's always when the child's imagination has taken them beyond what you've written on the page. So they've imagined something more than you ever intended. And in some cases, just imagined something completely different happening in your book. And she said, that's when you see the sort of the magic that you've done with these words, is that somebody's imagination has completely taken them elsewhere. So I suppose in a way it's a great compliment that's happened. And in fact, a few people have, in a couple of reviews and things, people have said something about the, I don't want to give anything away about the ending for people who've not read it, but the kind of the final sort of battle and the kind of the spell that Ariamwen uses towards the end and what they felt that had to do with. And it's quite interesting because a couple of people now have said that they thought it was to do with something, and I don't want to say what it is in case I put ideas in people's heads, but it never was meant to be this kind of what people have sort of made it out to be. That's the worst description of anything ever.
That's quite elliptical.
It's work like you've been censored.
Yeah, beep. Work that one out if you possibly can. I have no idea what I was talking about.
I like the idea that you're talking and every time you're talking, we can't see you obviously, but you've got Barry Cunningham behind you just watching you, and every time you're about to say something you look at him and he just shakes his head and you're like
there's like 15 sensors in the room with me at the moment,
yeah. Monitoring you. Well, fantastic stuff. So our discussion today, as previously stated, is about made up words. So we've talked a little bit about, obviously, the apprentice witch. And I think it's talking still on the subject of children's books. It's only right that we jump from the apprentice witch to Roald Dahl, I think.
Gobblefunk, the word from the title, is actually the word that he used to describe his own, well, not quite made up language, because language would be a bit too broad, but his own made up words. So, for example, if you've read the BFG, you've got ucky slush for something which is really disgusting.
Yeah.
Whiz popping, which is a bodily function that, you know, everybody does, but
we don't like to talk about.
and various other words like that. Scrumdiddlyumptious for something that's where that originally came from, I think. And I think Bernard Matthews' Turkey Burgers then took it on years later for advertising. And he's got lots and lots of them. And, you know, whether you are on board as a Roald Dahl fan or not, he does have a way of cutting through with language and really communicating with children. And this year in the UK, the Summer Reading Challenge, obviously I work in a library, is Roald Dahl. So we've got lots of themes to do with words and language, or language, as you would call it, to do with Roald Dahl. So it's interesting looking at that sort of side of things as well. There's a tremendous amount of power in words, and particularly words written in books and in books for children, because children have got this wonderful way of making sense out of things that they don't understand, rather like your cow charms, in fact, James. I'll give you a scenario. This is one which will embarrass no one except myself. When I was about 6 or 7 years old, I heard the term held in police custody for the first time. This immediately conjured
I can see
up
where this is going.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even terribly original, really. Then at 6 or 7, perhaps I wasn't. But it was about criminals needing to be held in this large vat of rather thick yellow custard. And I imagined the sort of custard that my dad makes, which is the best custard ever. And when I said this to my dad a couple of years later, when I was about 9, and he said, "Where did you get that rubbish from?" It's like, well, no one ever explained it to me, and I'd never seen the word written down. So the other example would be, I was brought up Catholic, as I mentioned it. So one of the first things you learn really early on is the Lord's Prayer. And it gets to, "And hallowed be thy name." But that makes no sense to a child, because we don't know what hallowed means. So it became, "Harold be thy name." And it was years before anyone corrected me on that.
Oh, fantastic.
So I mean, that's the sort of, you know, it's funny, but it's also the power that words can have, and being able to communicate with children effectively using a fantasy language, something that conjures up what you want them to see. But at the same time, sort of plugs into that bit of the imagination.
Yeah, and I think that Roald Dahl really got it right, because we'll talk about his reasons, especially with the BFG, because he had another reason for doing the language the way that he did. But he really got it right because he tapped into this essence of how children understand the world around them. And when I was little, I had a word for tights. I didn't call them tights. I called them sock jumpers. I called them sock jumpers because when I wore tights, they would go right up to my shoulders, because I was small and they were very long. So they were sock jumpers, which was a totally logical thing for them to be called, to be honest. And as we got older, and I used to come up with all sorts of stuff like that. It was just what I did. And you know, people used to say, actually, the thing is, even without her having to explain what she's saying, we understand what she's saying, because listening to the words is enough to interpret it. And we came up with a game that we played as a family called the sock jumper game, where someone would come up with a word, you know, like light bulb or light or tree or something like that, and we'd all have to come up with the sock jumper equivalent word for it, which is something that a child would call it, like a phone would be called a beep de beep, and etc 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 etc. And playing that game was always wonderful, because it always started off as everyone being really sort of almost trying to be too clever, but the people who tried to be too clever never won the game. And it was only when you sort of stepped back and stopped thinking about it, and you just looked at an object as if you were looking at it for the first time, as if you didn't know what it was and you were just trying to describe it. And the responses that came out of that were totally wonderful. And even without having to say what the word was, you could just say this made up word and everyone would understand what you were trying to say. And Roald Dahl understood that. He understood that the wonder of these words came with their simplicity, which meant that when a child picked it up, it might as well have already been in their vocabulary. They know exactly what it is.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know that snozcumbers taste horrible from the word, the word snozcumber.
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't... Literally, you hear that word, you need no other description, do you? But the other thing about Roald Dahl, and the more serious aspect, was that I believe when he was writing it, and I may be wrong in this, I believe his wife was suffering from dementia. Is that correct? There was someone in his life suffering from dementia.
Yeah, I think, I'm not sure if it was his wife, but there was something like that, yeah.
And he was looking at how she was interpreting the world as well, and how she was speaking and how she was translating. Her thoughts. And so that was also having a very big effect on how he was writing. And I think a fine example of that is the whole right-left thing. Right as in right having two meanings, as in direction and right. And then left, which is, there's only left, you know? But the way he used that, again, something we immediately understand, something we immediately know is wrong, but we understand anyway, I think really showed a kind of a deep understanding of the human mind and how we can muddle things up, and how someone suffering from dementia could muddle these sorts of things up.
Yeah.
think as well, because nobody had done that in children's literature up to that point, had they? Nobody had really
No.
not. I mean, people had made up names for countries and things like that, with, like Tolkien, which I'm sure we'll talk about, but nobody had made up those gloriously funny words that just, like you said, just completely summed up without the need for any sort of description, and it just entirely appealed to the child in everybody, with these really daft, silly words. And there is something hugely fun about making up names, isn't there? I mean, all of the things with writing The Apprentice, which making up names of things, sometimes it's difficult because you're thinking, oh, I just can't think of anything, and then but sometimes it's glorious. And one of the things that I've done with some of the groups of children is creating magical creatures, so they have to draw it, and then they have to decide some kind of interesting facts about it, like where it lives and what it feeds off of and all of that kind of stuff, and they have to give it a name. And we were doing this last Sunday at Heffers in Cambridge, and this young lad, he came up with this creature called a golden Scamander. That was it. And I thought, that's fantastic. In fact, I wrote it down, I've stolen it, and I paid him 50p for the rights to use that name in a future book. But I just thought that was just, they just come up with the most glorious things. He was like four, and he just came up with this completely batty name for a thing. So yeah, I think that with the Roald Dahl particularly, it appeals to children so much, and it was such a unique thing for quite a long time as well. I think there wasn't anybody for a long time that would do it. I think probably because people would see it as a kind of a bit of a rip-off of his genius, wouldn't they? If people did it. Tried to do it in the same way that he had done it, because he did it so well.
And I think also there was Roald Dahl, when it came to his writing, didn't take it as seriously. Now, when I say seriously, he had this sense of fun when it came to writing. I think he internally he was quite a juvenile person, if that makes sense. And when he was writing, that juvenile part of him came out. And when he was writing for children, he wasn't trying to be serious. And the children's fiction for a long time suffered from fiction being totally moralistic, it being a lesson, it being about teaching children. And whilst there are definitely little sort of lessons within Roald Dahl's writing, that wasn't the core of what he was trying to do. And so I think he was quite, he, that's why he stood out, because he was quite a cheeky person. He was quite, he was a humorous person. One only has to read his fairy tales to know that he was not, he was not conventional in that respect. And I think now, the wonderful thing now is that we are once more seeing this joy in children's fiction, where we're treating children with respect. We're not treating them like they need to be taught everything. We're treating them as thinking individuals, who we want to entertain, who we see as an audience, not as, I'm a student, if that makes sense in that regard.
And it's an interesting point you brought up, because sort of, well, early Roald Dahl books, or around that sort of time, was about the same sort of time when there seemed to be not a ban so much on children's fantasy, but a serious question on whether or not it was actually damaging in some way in encouraging children to enter fantasy worlds that, you think you might actually be creating a whole series or generations of maladjusted adults who couldn't deal with reality with, whereas in fact the reverse was actually closer to the truth. So for a while, fantasy really suffered there. I think it was something that Diana Wynne Jones brought up in her book of essays. She said it was very difficult for a while to get fantasy for children published, not because the publishers didn't like it, but because the general consensus on the people buying the books for the children were, you should buy them things that teach them about real life. And a lot of the children didn't actually want to read those sort of books either.
No.
No, I was definitely not a real lifer as a reader, as a child. I was not. I know, it's one of those things that comes up time and time again, doesn't it, about children in certain situations wanting to see that reflected in the books that they read. If children are, going through difficult things in their life, no matter what it might be. But personally, I mean, not that I didn't have a scarred childhood or anything like that, but my parents were divorced, and you know, that wasn't that nice, and it wasn't that, you know, there weren't that many people who I knew whose parents were divorced when I was very small, so that was quite unusual. But I didn't want to read anything. There were books about that kind of stuff then either, but I wanted to escape the real world. Those kind of fantasy things were what helped me to do that. So I think that's a really important thing to have. You know, you need to have that mixture, don't you? But I agree, there certainly wasn't a great deal that was available to me as a child, sort of in the, I don't know, 80s, early 90s, that was kind of great fantasy, not the richness that I think children get today.
Yeah.
And I think a big part of that, having been a bookseller sort of in the late 90s onwards, was because of Harry Potter. Really, it just opened that door again, I think, for really fantastic fantasy. And there was good fantasy there, but I don't think it wasn't heralded and shouted about in the way that we do today.
Yeah, I don't think it was quite. It wasn't really taken seriously.
Yeah, it wasn't treated with great respect. Yeah.
No.
But talking about fantasy and talking about language, we ought to give a passing nod at least to the master linguist, which is Tolkien, who actually invented about four or five languages.
I withhold that Tolkien didn't actually want to write a book. No. Tolkien wanted to write a language and wanted to write about nature. That's the two things he wanted to do. And everyone said, you can't just do that. And he went, oh, fine, I'll write an epic book while I'm at it. But I think the rest of it was done kind of begrudgingly.
It's funny you should say that. Again, referring back to Diana Wynne Jones's book of essays, she actually took his class on Anglo-Saxon at Oxford, and she said he was the most terrible lecturer. He didn't look at anybody. He talked down into his notes, and you got the distinct sense that he didn't want to be in the room with you. He wanted to be off writing about his hobbits and his other languages the whole time. And I can actually kind of see that.
Yeah, no, he was a linguist. That's what it was. And so the languages he was creating could have been real in some respects. They really were born of something old and historical, most Lord of the Rings.
You can actually learn Elvish if you want to and have full conversations in it.
Oh, trust me, I know. One of my friends is actually able to completely write in it. But when she was a little bit younger, she completely learnt it. And I was talking to her the other day and she said, I'm sorry, I'm just trying to translate one of my stories. And I was there like, what do you mean translate one of your stories? You can only speak English. She said, oh, well, I was in public. I didn't want anyone to read it. So I wrote it all in Elvish and now I'm trying to translate it back. And I'm like, why? Why would you do that to yourself? Kind of
I'm just wondering whether you can get one of those CD courses, you know, like Michelle Thomas, learn Elvish in a week.
The Rossi, what was it? The Rossi Stone?
Rosetta
Stone. Rosetta Stone and Elvish. You know, I don't think it's that far-fetched. I think that we're entering an era, the era of the nerd, where we no longer have to hide. We can now be proud because, you know, there's a lot of us and we can connect and there's power in numbers. So, you know, I wouldn't actually be surprised if there wasn't a proper course you could learn. I mean, you can learn Klingon and stuff like that. I've heard of people...
You can learn the Klingon dictionary in a week.
Yeah,
it's not that, like, diverse a language.
I've heard of people who literally met at conventions and they were both from different countries and they couldn't speak each other's language and they literally got talking in Klingon and they ended up getting married. And I thought that's the most amazing thing ever.
That's kind of wonderful, but also a bit frightening, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's just the idea that the language that they sort of kind of got to know each other through, and obviously then they learned to speak each other's language, but the initial contact language is this fictional language that doesn't actually exist within the universe as we understand it. I just think that's great. I think it's wonderful.
That's another thing.
I still
about...
can't get over your friend who thought it was fine to sit and write Elvish in public but wouldn't write in English in public.
I think the content was a little bit suspect, if I...
Oh, I see.
From my understanding.
Yes. Saucy Elvish.
Very, very saucy Elvish, I think. But I won't name who it is.
Elrond would never have books like that in his library.
Oh man, I don't know. Like reading the elves in the Hobbit and stuff like that. I think that they were actually a lot more into the silly stuff than you see them in the films. I mean, in the books, as the hobbits are leaving, the elves are kind of lounging around, drinking and laughing at them. You can't tell me that they haven't got a few, romantic novels hiding hiding under their beds and stuff like that. No, I wouldn't believe it for a second.
Okay, slight tangent there.
Sorry.
Talking about the power of words, has anybody else read David Edding's Belgariad series?
No, but it was, I mean, talking, I mentioned earlier being a bookseller, it was massively, massively popular when I was a bookseller. And people were always raving about it.
Well, it is good. I mean, a lot of it is quite tongue-in-cheek fantasy humour, so I found it quite light, but it is fun. But one of the concepts I really liked in there was the magic system works by the will and the word. The will is the force, if you like, not the force as in Star Wars, but force and the function of magic. And the word is form. And even from a martial arts perspective, there's no good having force if you can't contain it in a form. The same with magic. So you had to have the will to be able to do something magically and then give it shape by saying the correct words. And the words could be something very, very simple, such as move if you want a rock to get out of the way. And it was just a really interesting concept. And that is literally the magical system of the Belgariad. It's no more complicated than that.
Well, you wouldn't. I'm all for simplicity because you think, gosh, and there's so many books in that series as well, aren't there? You just think if it got too complicated, if it's too complex. Even now, sometimes, like editing book two, I'm suddenly like, oh no, I've got to use a spell now, and I don't know which is going to be the best glyph to use for this. And I have to go back and look at my own notes to decipher which one I think is going to be the right one, because you just know at some point somebody's going to know this stuff better than I do, and they're going to catch me, and they're going to say, no, she shouldn't have used that spell because. So yeah, I think keep it as simple as you possibly can. I'm all for simplicity. I think Tolkien got a bit carried away with himself.
I
it didn't
love.
need to be that complex, did it?
I just love the idea that an ordinary word can be magical, because if you think about it, an ordinary word in the right place, used in the right way, is magical. It can completely change the decision someone's about to make, or inspire them to do something that perhaps they wouldn't have thought of doing, or discourage them from doing something bad.
No, I'm with you on that, and I'm definitely with you, James, on the whole overcomplicating things. And I think Tolkien did go a little bit far, but then I think that it's what he wanted to do, really. So you can't really blame him. But speaking about the complications and names and stuff like that, I actually thought I'd talk a little bit about the Hamartia cycle, because Jules has read the first two books, and Jules knows that I created a whole bunch of gods, and. One of the criticisms everyone's just there, like, I have no idea which god anyone is talking about at any time. And I said, trust me, I didn't know while I was writing it either. I had to keep checking back with my notes. I thought, why did I create so many of them? And it was because I was influenced by all the cultures I've been living in, etc., etc., etc. But someone did actually ask me once, they said, are the gods based on anyone? And I said, well, the gods are probably quite influenced by the Greek gods in some respects. And they said, but what about the names? Because the names feel like they're based on something. And I had to make a confession about the names of the gods. And the names of the gods go as such. It's Malak, Aetheus, Prospan, Helix, Penthar, Hexius, Septus, Octania, Atia, Notomir. It took me a moment. So those are the 10 gods. And someone just said, where do the names come from? And apart from Helix, Atia, and Notomir, at the time that I was writing it, I just finished my GCSEs, and I had real trouble with chemistry. And my father made me learn the alkanes. He made me learn memorize the alkanes. So when I wrote the names for the characters, it was methane, ethane, propane, butane, pentane, hexane, septane, octane, etc., except nonane. And so there would be M, Malak, Aetheus, Prospan. I wasn't even trying. And when I told my father this, he stared at me like I'd betrayed him, like I'd taken something sacred. This, you know, chemistry. I thought he'd be pleased. I thought he'd get the joke, but he looked at me as I took something tangible and I made it into nonsense. And he was there like, oh, how can a daughter of mine massacre science so badly? He didn't believe me. He couldn't believe that I'd done it.
I wondered why the gods seemed really familiar in that. No, I know.
Yeah, it's because they're literally
really good at chemistry as well.
That's probably why they could make things happen.
They're all just master scientists. That's exactly what's happening. But yeah, so they are just based on the Latins 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, which actually made it easier for me to memorize ultimately, because I could remember which one was which, based on the number that went beside it. So there you go. It was nothing to do with anything magical. There was no meaning. I like having meaning in all of the names, but that one was just for my dad, because he'd annoyed me so much when I was learning chemistry. So that's my confession.
Has anybody ever worked that out?
No, thankfully they haven't, but now I've admitted
you've outed
it.
Yourself.
Yeah.
I've outed myself. Other people, I like it when other people notice stuff about the other names that I did, because I think names are incredibly important. Like, for instance, a lot of the names are nods to other things, and the one I'm proudest of is that, and the one that no one noticed, which I was kind of disappointed about, was one of the characters is called Fay O'Meara, and Fay O'Meara means warrior of the sea, and she's based on Morgana Le Fay from the Arthurian legend, Morgana meaning of the sea. So I literally just switched the name around. So names are incredibly powerful things, and what influences them can also actually really be quite telling about what you're writing. So you can make it a joke like I did with the gods, or you can actually really do something, you can try and do something significant with it. But if, as I've discovered, if you try to be too secretive, no one may notice.
Okay, that's an interesting point for both of you, actually. How do you go about actually naming your characters? Do you sit down and really think about it, or do you find that they just sort of wander in and name themselves like cats? Which is what happens to me.
I think it's a bit of both, really. I've got a notebook somewhere that's got a whole long, great big list of names that I was going to use for different characters in the book. And they were all completely wonderfully made up. And there were lists for boys and lists for girls and lists of surnames and lists of places. And and I could really look at that. I just let people, like you say, wander in and kind of go, I think I'd quite like this name, actually. I think lots of people are disappointed that there aren't characters in the book named after them. But I think you run such a risk, don't you, starting to name people after people you know.
Yeah. The name chooses the character, Mr. Nicol. The name chooses the character.
It's an odd mix. Yeah, I think, and sometimes you start to think of a character and the name comes in and then you're like, oh, he can't be called that because that's too similar to this other character that's here. Or surnames start to sort of overlap and you're like, oh no, that's too many people whose surnames sound like that sort of a name. So you go back and change stuff. So I pick things from all over the place, really. I certainly don't go back to that notebook with that gloriously great big long list in it.
I'm absolutely forbidden from using the name Matthew again. One of my friends who is also a guest on the show, he's another writer, and I just didn't make the connection that in one story I'd had a character called Matthew and something really nasty happens to Matthew at the end of that story. Then in another story, in fairness to me, that story was written before I knew him. There's another story, these both got published, by the way, and there's a character, again, called Matthew, and something rather nasty happens to Matthew halfway through the story.
Oh, sure.
And he read both of them quite close together, and I got this little message saying, are you trying to tell me something? And I really hadn't made the connection. It's like, oh, no, I'm really sorry, but feel free to, you know, kill me off in your next story. Just do it in a really interesting way. Yeah. So I have to stay away from that one.
It is the problem, and I think fantasy is kind of good in that respect, because you can come up with all sorts of really crazy names and be like, haha, I don't know anyone called Aberswitch. But with naming, for me, names are really important, and sometimes characters come in and I just know their names. In the case of the Hamashiach cycle, Yonathan is obviously based on Jonathan, who is my brother, who hasn't read the book yet, but when he does, I think he's going to have a few choice words about the character that I named after him and the things that happened to said character. I think he's not going to be very happy with me. But yeah, I try to make sure that the names and the character are connected. And sometimes I can spend a very, very long time trying to find a character's name and it'll click. And this isn't the Hamashiach cycle. This is another story, another series that I'm working on, where I have a character he's an albino dragon.
Obviously,
yes.
And this Not enough albino dragon.
And this is set in a Middle Eastern equivalent kind of world, and they're in an equivalent of Northern Cyprus, basically, which is obviously a Turkish Cypriot. And I could not find a name for him. And one of the other elements of the story is that a lot of traditionally female qualities in our world are considered male in that world, so having long hair, being well pampered, being, you know, beautiful, etc., etc., etc. They say that that's a male quality because it's always the male of the species who has to try and attract the female, so they're the ones who have to sort of prune themselves. And I could not find a name for this character. I was going through, I was losing my mind, and then I was just sitting in the sitting room one day, and this name Island popped into my head, and I thought, I wonder what Island means. So I looked up Island. And Aylin is a Turkish girl's name that means moonlight. And I thought, could there literally have been anything that was more perfect than a feminine name about moonlight, which is this pale thing, and he's often compared to moonlight, that's Turkish? And I just thought at that moment, the name literally just flew across the universe to come and into my head, that it managed to be so perfect. And I didn't even find it. It just appeared. And so I was very chuffed about that. I sort of ran around the house, told Sean as quickly as I could. And that there was a kind of magic in that. I was very chuffed. So I think that names have a special power. And you know when you've got your character's name, because this sense of completion slides into place, and it's almost like you've been working with a silhouette and then you get their name and you see their face, and it's almost this, oh, hello, there you are. I know who you are now. And I think that it's the most magical thing in writing, to be honest.
I've discovered, as well as part of the, this does tie into names, trust me, doing the school visits and things, I quickly realised that I don't know how children spell their names anymore, because when I was growing up, everybody was called Sally or James, and I knew how to spell both of those names. And now children have the most fantastic names, spelled in the most unusual way. And even names that you think you know how to spell, you don't. So, you know, like a child will come up to you and say that their name's Ben, and you're immediately suspicious that it's going to have like an X in there somewhere. But yeah, I've collected some really great names that are going to be, you know, characters in future books. So that's been a plus side, actually. Some beautiful, beautiful names. Also some very strange names for children. But it's been really, that's been a really good sort of source for future names for characters as well. So I highly recommend stealing names from children.
that sounds quite malicious. That sounds like a kind of Spirited Away kind of thing, going around stealing names from children. The name stealer, that's the next book. Someone who goes around stealing names. Now here's a question, have we got any more Welsh names?
Not so far, no. And I've met a few people with character names from the book, which has been quite nice. Not many. And I did sign a book for a lady, her son wasn't with her, but she said, will you sign this book for me, please? It's for my son. And she was Japanese, so I was immediately kind of on guard, ready with my practice pad, spell this child's name, assuming it was going to be something Japanese and quite tricky. And I said, and what's your son's name? And she said, it's Bob. So I said, oh, well, it just so happens that there is a Bob in the book. So I hope she doesn't mind when she gets to the bit where she discovers who Bob is.
I can't understand how anyone is going to complain about Bob in the book. He's the best character.
No more Welsh names. But I did suddenly, I realised kind of, I don't know why, I only realised about a week before the book was published. The bus in the book, so the bus that the Ariane went arrived in Lull on, is called Beryl, and it's one of my grandmother's names, and I don't think I really intended to name a bus after her. I'm not sure she'd be terribly pleased. And the worst of it is that you know, all of my family can read it now. I'm waiting for somebody to go, how dare you name a bus I'm thinking either they don't mind, or secretly none of them have read it yet or noticed. But I kind of, after, you know, a week before, I suddenly thought, I think I was going to actually change the name of the bus to something else. But it's not a bad thing to be named after. It's an all right bus. It's not a horrible bus. It's quite a cool character.
You do have a one defence. You can say, well, I didn't know her as Bertha. I knew her as a granny.
That's very true.
There you go. That's your line of defence. But I'm very disappointed that you don't have any more Welsh names. I'm going to make an entire joke. I was planning an entire joke around the fact that witches have Welsh names, all because of you, James. So I'm incredibly disappointed in you. I'm still going to do the joke in my next work. But yeah, there you go. You can feel honoured that you are the punchline of a joke. Not the punchline, but yeah, the inspiration.
I'm going to Wales for my holiday in a few weeks, so I might gather some more inspirational Welsh names whilst I'm there, I'm sure.
I'm looking forward to it. So I think we've skirted around it a little bit, but we should probably talk about Harry Potter.
Go on then.
Well, Jules ruined something for me before the episode started.
I do that occasionally.
She did. She totally ruined it for me. See, I have lived my whole life, that's a lie. But since I read Harry Potter, I have lived under the belief that J.K. Rowling came up with the word butterbeer, which I thought was the most wonderful word in the entirety of Harry Potter, because it was just so beautiful. You knew exactly what it was. It feels warm. It feels everything that butterbeer is supposed to be. So I was saying, oh yeah, we should talk about butterbeer in the episode today, Jules. And Jules turned around. She was just there like, yeah, but she didn't create the word butterbeer. It's from the Middle Ages. And I was so offended.
No, it's a traditional Elizabethan drink that was occasionally made with bear fat, but was a warm, sweet, buttery drink. It was you know, small beer loaded with honey and various other things. You can actually find recipes for it online if you happen to Google it.
See, I just thought the recipes that you saw online were people interpreting what butterbeer was supposed to taste like. I didn't realise it was actually already a drink. I'm so distraught.
I'm so sorry. I really
You just killed a small, bright part of me, Jules.
I mean, she made some wonderful words up, didn't she? And she made the spells were brilliant, because they just the way she fitted the bits of Latin together just made them sound, you know, they were accessible to children and adults, but at the same time they still felt other enough to actually be magic.
Well, the interesting thing about the way she did the spells, and I've heard a whole bunch of people say that actually they're based on real spells, and you know, the whole controversy about, oh, it's inciting people to turn into witches and stuff like that by the uber religious. But the interesting thing she did with language, with the spells, is how she decided to base some of the words. Now, I forgot the exact saying, but I believe it's we go to work in Norman and we come home in Saxon. In that our language itself, the way that we speak now in English, the way that it was built on the languages of the invading people who came, is that words in the outside, in the work environment, have more Norman words. So they have the Latin base. They are they come from the Norman invaders. Words in the home space, however, come from Saxon. A small example of this is beef. Beef as the thing that you eat is based on buff. It's a Norman word. But cow is Saxon origins. So you'd be at home, you'd be raising cows, and the people who'd be eating beef were the Normans, who were the rich ones, basically, the nobility. And what J.K. Rowling did was that with the spells that were kind of around the sort of the day-to-day, she had these Latin bases. And then with the spells which were to do with medical things, they had a Greek base occasionally.
Yeah.
And she picked up on these small linguistic things which shaped how she did the spells. And that was not something that a lot of other people kind of realised until it was revealed. But I thought that was incredibly clever.
Mm.
Yeah.
She'll sound sceptical.
No, not sceptical at all. That's the sort of thing I would enjoy and that I would probably sort of do in a way myself because I enjoy language. But I realise I'm a complete nerd when it comes to language and words. And so I wouldn't expect anybody else to necessarily think it was cool.
No, I think it's cool. Though speaking about the merger of languages and creating languages, I feel, Jules, that you've been incredibly quiet on this front.
Really?
Because, oh yeah. Yes, oh yes, because I have had the fortune.
You're in trouble now.
Yeah, she is in trouble. She doesn't like to talk about it. But I've read I Am the Silence, which is obviously the second book of Jules's fantastic Unveiled series. And in that, there is a language that appears, which is a merger of several languages, Celtic languages, as they are called. So tell us a little bit about that, Jules.
Well, the deathly tones there. Basically, I needed something that would have been spoken in Dorset around the Bronze Age. Not the Bronze Age. Between the Bronze Age and the Iron Age. Around Roman Dorset area.
Yep.
But it couldn't be Latin. It had to have been spoken by the natives. And there isn't anything left. There's no written record because they didn't tend to write things down. Except for some curse tablets, which were found in Bath and are now in the National Museum in London. And they've never been successfully translated. And I really thought that using random words from a curse tablet in a book might be a bit irresponsible. So I decided not to include those. But the closest I could find on doing a bit of research is a form of Cornish. So it's Cornish that I've used with a little bit of, Breton, which is quite similar, and some Goidithic in there as well. And I've moved words around, so it wouldn't have been how it was spoken. I've changed the phrasing to suit myself, basically. That's all I've done, because I had these entities that would not have spoken English as we speak it today. And I needed them to be convincing. but you can translate it, and it does sort of make sense. It's just that the sentence construction will look very strange. Because, for example, if you do speak Welsh or any Welsh at all, you wouldn't say the big house, you would say the house of bigness. So, and Cornish is very similar in its sentence construction. I actually learned a bit of Cornish so that I could do this convincingly. This is what I mean about being a tremendous word nerd. I said, I will actually go and learn a language in order to put it in a book for like 6 pages.
But there aren't, you don't really actually have much translation of what is being said.
Not until the main character sort of starts to understand it herself, no.
Yeah, but it's not, yeah. But I know you sort of changed things around a little bit, but how much of that was also to do with the aesthetic of how it sounded?
You caught me out there. yeah, I changed how things looked and how they would sound if they were read aloud, positioning words in different places in the sentence. They still made sense, but, it would have looked a little bit odd if you did a literal translation.
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, was to do with the aesthetic of how it would appear on the page and also how it would sound if it was read aloud.
Don't worry, I'm not scolding you for that. I think that aesthetic is actually quite rather important in storytelling, if I'm honest. Mm. Maybe Tolkien would have come and beat you with a stick, but, to be honest,
but it's
you could probably outrun him. So.
I mean, I think you can have... Yeah, well, yeah, hopefully. Certainly hopefully now. okay, that was a bit dark. going back to Cornish, there's one phrase that was absolutely beautifully described, and it's used as, it's sort of flung as a curse in the book. And this is Ceirin Spearn, and it sounds like someone means something like evil intentions, and it literally means crown of thorns. And it's the Cornish word is crap, it is for crown of thorns, but it also means hangover, which I thought was, you know, that's perfect.
Curse somebody with a hangover. I like it.
Or literally with, you know, blinding head pain. But I thought that was kind of for my own amusement. But there are others, and I think you can get away with words that probably literally don't mean anything. Again, we're back to Roald Dahl. If they've got that right sort of onomatopoeia about them, so that they, you know, they feel and they sound and they look either a bit magical or like, you know, that's something that's really disgusting. I don't need much more description. So that's part of the rearranging the words around.
Yeah. And what, going back to the sort of the aesthetic, I think aesthetic of words is what it all really boils down to. More than understanding in some ways, because obviously it needs to be understood if it's going to be in a book, because you need to be able to understand what's going on. But we're talking about words themselves having power, and the meaning is derived from that power rather than vice versa, if that makes sense. Am I making sense, or am I talking rubbish?
No, I think I follow you there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so Roald Dahl had these words that literally didn't make sense. They literally did not make sense. And yet they made total sense because there was this power behind what he was trying to say. And there was an understanding that if you looked at it from another perspective, it didn't follow any grammatical rules that we knew. And yet we understood it. And I think that is where language is born. And this will take me on to the last point that I'm going to make, which is I'm going to go way back. I'm going to talk about Shakespeare, because Shakespeare came up with a whole bunch of words which no one would have heard of before. Lovely, for instance, he made it up. And the first time anyone heard that, they would have understood exactly what he was trying to say. Again, you would have the context, but it didn't follow any grammatical structural rules that would have been understood at the time. And yet, but the one word that Shakespeare came up with that I love the most is elbow. No, and I really struggle to know how we managed to explain that, but you know, he says the elbow and people go, well, what's the elbow? You know, it's the bendy bit, the bendy bit in the arm. The what? You know, this bit. Like, no one had noticed elbows before. No one had bothered naming them. He came up with the word elbow. I just think that's the best.
Quite mad, isn't it? That's like,
it's crazy.
You say it, it's like, oh, hang on a second.
I didn't notice that before.
Or perhaps there was a name and he just didn't like it. And he was like, I'm sorry, I'm not calling it that. So I'm going to give it a new name. If it was that. I wonder if he disapproved of the original name of our elbows and so came up with that as a replacement.
Maybe people called
trying to
them
think
off.
Of something really rude that it might have been called before.
Well, maybe they called it something silly like arm knee or something. Or they might have just called it the joint, which is just boring. You know, Shakespeare had no time for boring stuff. So
that it hurts like hell when I whack it on a desk bone.
The bendy bit. So yeah, he came up with elbow, which I just think is fantastic. Because there is actually something that we can, you know, there's a language L and bow or something like that where it was born from. But right now, in this day and age, I can't see where that sort of came from. It sounds to me almost like he just pulled a sound out of the air and said, right, we're going to call it an elbow. Call what an elbow? That bit, that's an elbow now. Okay, all right. They just accepted it. But can you imagine life now if we did not have the word elbow?
Well, yeah, that's just weird, isn't it?
I'm just trying to think. I'm not sure it would really impact greatly on my life, to be honest. Unless you were a doctor who specialised in elbows. Then you might quickly come unstuck. You'd have to mime a lot, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
On my own level, I don't think it would cause me too much grief. I'll let you know. Actually, I'm going to keep a tally about how many times I say elbow this coming week.
Tell you what. No, we can do a challenge for the next week. We have to try and not say the word elbow and see how well that goes. Because you know, we say, oh, it wouldn't have much of an impact. But as a binational, There have been times in the day to day where I've forgotten how to say the words in English and I only know how to say them in French. And you'd be surprised how much of an issue that causes. Do you know how many times I've forgotten the word for socks? You wouldn't imagine that socks would be that much of an important word, but I tell you what, when you can't say the word socks, it becomes an issue, okay? I keep doing it around, I've said, the chaussette, and they're like, the what? And I'm like, the things that go on your feet underneath the shoes, and they're like, what are you talking about? So there we go, I challenge you, James. You have two challenges now. Give me another Welsh witch. And and try and go a week without saying elbow and see how you feel.
I'll let you know how I get
on. Right.
Challenge accepted.
Okay, well, I definitely want to feedback on this in a future podcast because this is great. We're going to have to wrap it up there, guys.
That's a shame. We were having fun.
That's me, the doom crow.
You're just ruining everybody's fun today, Jules.
Yeah,
first with pot of beer, now you're ending the episode at a sensible time. Well, just to review over what we've looked at then, we have obviously touched down on the progress of the Apprentice Witch. Again, congratulations to you, James, on that success. We've talked about Tolkien, we've talked about Roald Dahl, we've had a little tickle about Harry Potter and a lot of disappointment, and we've talked about Shakespeare. And Jules mentioned another few books that I never heard of before in my life. So.
All about the importance of language and especially creating words for children that are both descriptive and require no further description.
So, James, have we scared you off or are you going to come back for another episode sometime?
Oh, no, of course. I'd be more than happy to come back sometime.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, on that happy note, we'll say goodbye and we'll catch up with you guys next week.
Thanks very much, James.
Bye. Bye. Thank you.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders. Or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.